I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Imani Perry says her connection to playwright Lorraine Hansberry began with her adopted father, who adored Hansberry for her radicalism, her truth-telling, her beauty, her poise, and for being a seeker. Imani and her dad saw many different productions of A Raisin in the Sun. The play debuted on Broadway in 1959 when Hansberry was just 29 years old, the first Broadway play written by a black woman. It went on to win the New York Drama Critics Circle Award for Best Play. Lorraine Hansberry was far ahead of her time as a playwright and a social justice advocate. She married Robert Nemiroff, a Jewish communist, even though she identified as a lesbian and had lesbian lovers. Tellingly, he supported her work after their divorce and her untimely death when she was 34 years old. Imani Perry wants to give Hansberry her due, so she's written a book about her life called Looking for Lorraine, The Radiant and Radical Life of Lorraine Hansberry. And our guest is a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and joins us once again on Radio Times. Imani Perry, nice to have you back with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You describe this as a third-person memoir.
Yes.
Just deconstruct that for us.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, I think what the distinction between memoir and autobiography is really that it's less a detailing of every single event, but actually using a series of memories to make a set of observations about one's life and about life more broadly. And that's what I wanted to do. You know, I wanted to approach the work less like sort of, you know, getting every single detail and really exposing who Lorraine Hansberry was as an intellectual, as an artist, to give the reader a sense of her emotional life, her intellectual life, her journey, right? That was where I thought I had something to contribute. So that's why I have this sort of unusual title.
I struggled with trying to understand that, but it makes perfect sense because I feel as if maybe love is too strong a word, but mm-hmm. you so identify with her. I feel such a strong connection to her.
I do love her. I feel a deep sense of connection. One of the things that's been really powerful for me is that as I've traveled with the book, it's clear that many people do. She resonates very deeply with lots of people who have been hungry to know something more about her and sort of having the opportunity to capture what it is that so inspires about her has been really a gift for me.
Is it that she died so young? She was in her 30s when she died. The fact that she was a woman, the fact that she was a lesbian, the fact that she lived a sort of unconventional life, is that why we don't know her well enough?
I do think her early death, I think less because she was a lesbian and the fact that we didn't know that for a very long time, and it's almost as though much of her life has been obscured. And thankfully, you know, the Lorraine Hansberry Literary Trust has found a way to sort of respectfully give us access to the resources that would help us sort of tell the story of her life. And then also the period in which she died. You know, she died in January of 1965. Yeah. That's right in the midst of a season of so much death, social upheaval. It's almost as though she got her loss got lost in the midst of the telling of that period of history.
So much of Chicago seems to define her life. That's where she grew up. I would say a daughter, the fourth child, a daughter of a solidly middle-class family. Both her parents were college-educated, representing a certain part of what, the black middle class at that time in that place?
Yes. And, you know, she was middle class, but in the context of her neighborhood and in the context of the Depression, she was affluent, right? So her father was a real estate mogul. Everybody in black Chicago knew the Hansberries. So she grew up in the shadow of this very distinguished family. But also, and I think it's really important, at that point, black middle-class people lived in black communities, so she lived up close with poor and working-class black people and developed and had a very deep identification with poor and working-class people and sort of a vexed or a tense relationship with her class status, actually.
Well, I thought that was interesting. There was a time she went to school and I think was told or had a very nice coat, and she did not want to wear it.
Right. She was, and you know, if you have to think about, she was a fur coat, a white fur coat that her parents sent her to school in the midst of the Depression. You know, just sort of not great judgment. And she referred to herself as looking like a big stupid white rabbit.
A big stupid white rabbit.
Right.
And I think she, I know exactly what that looks like,
right.
too.
And she was beat up. And, you know, but she understood why. I find that really powerful that she... what resonated most deeply in that moment for her was how the other children must have felt. You know, everybody's hungry, right? And what it must have felt like to see this. And that, in some ways, is a key to what her politics became. And she was far left. That's part of my identification with her as political, you know, because she knew what things were like. For
right.
poor folks, yeah.
There's a really fascinating story. Her father was in real estate.
Yes.
And obviously real estate can be very fraught with redlining and segregation mm-hmm. and all of that. And certainly that was true in Chicago, but also was involved in a case that really went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Hansberry v. Lee went to the Supreme Court. And essentially over 80% of Chicago at the time she was coming up was covered by racially restrictive covenants. So Black people simply could not move into the vast majority of Chicago. There's thousands of people come migrating from the South with the dream, you know, of a better life in the North, and then concentrated in these tiny neighborhoods. And he devises this plan of basically breaking up larger apartments and creating kitchenettes. And he was called the Kitchenette King.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the Raising the Sun is based upon that idea. But he sues, essentially. Well, there's a lawsuit goes back and forth. But essentially, he purchases a home that was covered by a restrictive covenant. And ultimately, the Hansberry family wins. But in the process of occupying the home, it was in a white neighborhood, she is spat on. She has slurs yelled at her. You know, there's mobs outside the door. Her mother has to carry around a German Luger pistol. And a rock is thrown into the window, which narrowly misses Lorraine's head.
Right. Yeah. And could have seriously injured her.
Yeah.
Or maybe killed her.
Yes.
How much do you think all of that went into her writing of A Raisin in the Sun?
Well, it's clearly central in A Raisin in the Sun, but it's through her whole work. So she's constantly rewriting that moment over the years. Sort of, it was clearly traumatic. And then she fashions this play sort of around what are the desires that make a family want to move into a neighborhood mm-hmm. like this, and also see it as an act of courage, of extreme courage. It's important, though, that she makes the younger family in A Raisin in the Sun a working-class family instead of a middle-class family like hers. They occupy the kitchenette. They're not the owners of the kitchenette, you know.
Let me play, we should say, A Raisin in the Sun, not just on Broadway, but also was made into a movie in 1961. Mm-hmm. This is a scene Walter Lee, played by Sidney Poitier, is trying to convince his mother, played by Claudia McNeil, to let him invest their father's $10,000 insurance policy payment into a liquor store.
Sometimes it's like I can see my future just stretched out in front of me, my whole future. A big, blank, empty space full of nothing, just hanging at the edge of my days waiting for me, Mom. But it don't have to be, Mama. Sometimes when I'm downtown driving that man around, we pass them cool, quiet-looking restaurants. Mm-hmm. I look in. I see these white boys. They sit talking about deals worth millions of dollars, Mama, and half the time they don't look no older than me.
Oh, son, how come you talk so much about money?
Because it's life.
Oh, so now money is life. Once upon a time, freedom used to be life, but now it's money.
Mama, it was always money. We just didn't know it.
No, no, no. Something's changed. You're something new, boy. In my time, we was worried about not being lynched and getting to the North and how to stay alive and still have a pinch of dignity, too. Now here come you and Benita talking about things we ain't hardly ever thought about, me and your daddy. You ain't satisfied or proud of nothing we done. I mean that you had a home and that we kept you out of trouble till you was grown and that you don't have to ride to work on the back of nobody's streetcar. You're my children, but how different we've become.
You don't understand. You don't understand.
Such a powerful scene. You have probably seen that movie untold numbers of times.
I have that version, and then there was an American Playhouse version in the 80s, and then there was a more recent version which starred Felicia Rashad. So it's also quite powerful to sort of see the different interpretations. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but yeah, it's an amazing scene. It's beautifully written.
How do you interpret what she was saying in that play?
Well, you know, what I think, and it's interesting because Hansberry was very self-critical of the fact that there wasn't a singular character who stood out. But I think she was a master of the ensemble form. So what you get in that moment is this really sensitive portrait of both Walter Lee and Mrs. Younger. And, you know, why... I mean, you can understand why they're at odds, but also the motivations for each, the desires for each, and that happens throughout the play. So it's just the human dynamic and this struggle to aspire to a life that is meaningful, to somehow a life that's not constrained by racial injustice, that is shaped by gender and generation and place in history. I just think it's remarkably accurate. Yeah.
Well, it certainly debuted on Broadway to much acclaim, I should say. Looking back, or maybe even at that time, or maybe even how Lorraine Hansberry felt about the critics, did the critics understand what she was trying to say in this play?
No.
No.
Most critics did not. And there's several different schools of criticism that she... And Lorraine, you know, she was sort of remarkable in that she was very outspoken against critics, and she would write letters in response to their errors, which is sort of unheard of.
A little scary to do, right?
But, you know, so there were the critics who said it's a universal play. It's not really about race. It's a play with a happy ending. And she said not only is it not that, but it is a very specifically Chicago play because all of these dramas around housing and desegregation are so deeply a part of Chicago history and the story of migration there. And then there were the critics who were other members of the Black left who thought the play was this assimilationist fantasy. And that was really very painful for her, too, because they also missed the fact that she wasn't trying to write dogma. She was writing how people were actually feeling and thinking, right, and trying to expose the source of that. I mean, Walter Lee... It's not an accident that Walter Lee and Willie Loman have the same initials, right? I mean,
interesting.
Yeah, there's a way in which she's sort of imagining how the death of a salesman, the questions raised there, particularly affect Black men in America, for example. Yeah.
Let me just quickly reintroduce. That's Imani Perry, and she's got a new book. It's called Looking for Lorraine, The Radiant and Radical Life of Lorraine Hansberry. And we just played a clip from A Raisin in the Sun. That's her Broadway debut play that she wrote. It made its debut in 1959 and went on to win the New York Drama Critics Circle Award for Best Play. She was just 29 years old at the time. To join our conversation, any questions or comments you might have, 1-888-477-9499. You can also email us, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I made a giant leap from her being a young girl to A Raisin in the Sun, but there's some things I do want to talk about in those intervening years. Mm-hmm. One, that she was... not a great student, can we say that?
Yes.
Not a stellar student?
Yes, and that's actually one of my favorite details of her life. You know, she was not a stellar student. She did poorly in drama. She did poorly in literature. She was on academic probation several times. She dropped out of the University of Wisconsin and then Roosevelt University and then the New School. And I find that so useful right now in particular because I think it's really important that when we keep our eyes open for genius or excellence, that we don't only look at the conventional pathways. I mean, here's an example of someone who just was extraordinarily gifted but struggled with school.
Yeah. I mean, do you think she was what we would call a late bloomer, or that she is there any way to know why she and school did not connect?
I think, you know, well, we do know she was a voracious reader, and she was someone whose mind raced in dozens of different directions. So she was probably distracted in school. She was probably really imaginative and probably had a difficult time following the formulas of school and the constraints. That's my guess. And then there was also, she did talk about being the product of Jim Crow schooling, and that the quality of the education she received was subpar. I mean,
she knew that,
and she struggled even with basic arithmetic into adulthood, like with making change at stores. And so that was a piece too.
She eventually ends up in New York, Greenwich Village.
Yes,
and she meets and becomes really good friends with James Baldwin. Knows
W.B. Du Bois. Yeah,
was he alive at that time then?
Yeah, he was, and he became her mentor. Yeah, and teacher. Yeah,
Nina Simone, Paul Robeson. I mean, I guess this is in certain ways what we call the Harlem Renaissance.
Well, it's sort of post Renaissance, but it is a period in which there's sort of the end of like sort of the flourishing period of you know, both the intellectual and artistic period for Black life, and a lot of it was both a lot of the institutions that were fostered by both the WPA and by the Communist Party had created this amazing artistic and intellectual community that she benefited from, even though she was younger than most of the people.
Because this was post-war,
I guess.
That would have been a little different. James Baldwin called her Sweet Lorraine.
Yes.
Tell us what he meant by that.
Well, I think partially it's a reference to the Nat King Cole song, Sweet Lorraine. And her mother sometimes called her that too. But also I talk about how sweet is this designation that's really common in Black communities that doesn't have much crossover discussion. But it's a way of describing a disposition that is gentle, that is caring, not weak, right? Not fragile, and oftentimes very steely. But it's common to hear people refer to, she's sweet. Right. Uh-huh. And so there's a tenderness there. And a lot of their relationship was actually what they both referred to as down home, like a very and both of them sort of occupy these worlds that were not overwhelmingly Black and sometimes very, very few other. But when they were together, they, you know, really were in that space of like home. Right? And so that makes sense.
We're almost up in a break here, but I mean, marriage is probably too strong a word, but there was a very strong connection between these two.
Absolutely. A very intimate friendship. Yeah.
I mean, a marriage of sorts, even if it wasn't.
Yes, absolutely. And I actually think one of the things that for me is meaningful about this book was for me to find a way to talk about friendships that are so intimate that we should talk about them in ways that are akin to marriage. Long-lasting relationships of deep trust and engagement, you know, over a time period.
Well, I do want to talk about her actual marriage, which
yes.
I think fits into what you just said there. Again, Imani Perry is our guest. She's got a new book, Looking for Lorraine, The Radiant and Radical Life of Lorraine Hansberry. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and if you're just joining us, Imani Perry is our guest. She's the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies and Faculty Associate in the Program in Law and Public Affairs at Princeton University. She's been a guest on Radio Times a number of times over the years, often talking about her books, and she's got a new one, again, called Looking for Lorraine, The Radiant and Radical Life of Lorraine Hansberry. You can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You said during the break there that you're glad she's not an icon, that she can't be fit. She's not fit easily and comfortably into various boxes.
Yeah. I mean, I worry that oftentimes, you know, we make an era of memes. We make these iconic figures. And it makes it hard to use them for thinking about our current moment and our how we pursue our passions and how we try to create. And so I like that she's so flesh and blood in so many ways, because her life really can sort of be a testament to trying to figure things out, which is what we all need to do.
Yes, we do. Well, part of her complexity is she married a guy named Robert Nemiroff.
Yes.
He was a Jewish communist
yes.
at the time, unabashed, I should say.
Yes.
And you include a letter, a piece of a letter that she writes to him. "My dear Bob, once again, I wrote you a very long letter. The important simple things which it said were that I finally admitted to myself, I do love you, you wide-eyed, immature, unsophisticated revolutionary." So that's...
Yes.
Lorraine Hansberry in love.
Right,
that's
right.
That's how she expressed her love.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's, there's no question to me that he remained her best friend, right? If not one of her, I mean, one of her best friends. Their relationship did not last a terribly long time as a romantic relationship. And even at the beginning, it's clear that there was some difficulty, which probably had something to do with her sexuality and also, you know, that she was a restless person generally. But he really devoted his life to protecting her ability to do the work she felt called to do.
He believed in her.
He believed in her. And I think it's remarkable for a man in the mid-20th century to sort of organize his life around, you know, the work that a woman was artist was doing. I mean,
and a black woman at
that. And I do think that he deserves abundant credit for having that role in giving us Lorraine. I mean, both financial support, but also, you know, when she threw her drafts away, pulling them out of the garbage and putting them back in front of her, that kind of work.
You talk about her restlessness. And also, in fact, this was with James Baldwin, a kind of a shared loneliness.
Yes, she was deeply lonely. And I also thought that was really – that was part of what was profound for me in research, is that she had beautiful friendships, people who loved her deeply, and also really struggled with loneliness and depression at various moments. And I think it had to do with the world was not a place that could really accommodate her. And so that even when you find connection with other people, when you don't fit neatly into the terms and the logic of the society, it can be a struggle. And I really find that useful to think about how people can be friends with a shared loneliness.
Indeed. Well, she did seem to truly love a woman named Molly Malone Cook, who was a photographer. Tell us about her.
She was a Californian photographer who for most of her life was partnered with the poet Mary Oliver. And that's actually the cover photo to the book. Mary Oliver is the person who allowed us to use that as the cover photo, because it's, you know, she has Molly Malone Cook's archives. But I found that this relationship really meaningful to me, in part because there's a resonance between Molly's photography. She was one of the original staff photographers at the Village Voice and opened the first art gallery in Provincetown, which, you know, has become like a sort of classic location for LGBTQ communities to have, to have a kind of summer space. And that, you know, Molly did these photographs that you get this sense of like landscape and sort of the dynamic relationship between objects and people. And I think that was Lorraine's gift too. So just imagining what it was like for them to be these two young artists sort of developing their voices, as it were, their styles, was really kind of interesting and exciting.
You write, "These photos are different from all the others and tell a story in and of themselves. In them, Lorraine does not have her race woman armor on, as she usually does, nor is she posed. She's casual, tomboyish."
Yes, and the photographs that Molly took of Lorraine, they're just so tender, and they are sort of undressed, and you don't, I mean, you can see the intimacy in them because she's not protecting herself. Her arms are not folded as they are in many of the other photographs. So I found them really special. Yeah.
Did she, because you look through a lot of letters and archives, mm-hmm. was she in love with Molly Malone Cook?
Well, you know, I can't say definitively. I think from what I have access to, and we'll hear more. There's a biographer working on actually a biography of Mary Oliver that will talk more about Molly's experience with Lorraine. Oh. She suggested that to me. I know that Molly was in love with Lorraine. I don't know the extent of the other way around, actually.
Lorraine had a pen name, Emily Jones.
Yes.
And a whole other, I guess, writing life.
Yeah. Yeah. So this pen name, Emily Jones, is what she used for all of her lesbian themed fiction. Both, some of which was published in what were then called homophile magazines, right? Gay and lesbian magazine, yeah. And then some of which was unpublished, but she still wrote sort of Emily Jones at the top of the. So it's almost like she took on this this other writing identity, and the style is different.
Oh, so it doesn't sound like Lorraine Hansberry?
Well, it sounds like her, but it's the writing is more lyrical. There's more attention to color and texture and beauty in their writing. So it's not as though it sounds like a completely different person, but there's a shift in style. Yeah, absolutely.
She was, I mean, politically active is almost a cliche.
Yeah.
I mean, how would you describe her kind of activism?
So she was, I guess, kind of ecumenical. Like she was, you know, she was at certain points, a member of the Communist Party. She remained a socialist. She was an anti-colonialist, in some ways a Pan-Africanist and a Black nationalist, but also they're deeply connected to multiracial socialist communities. But she was the kind of old-school Marxist who sort of believed that any step of people, working people, oppressed people, moving towards, like, resisting their domination was meaningful, right? Uh-huh. So she wasn't like doctrinal in the way where she was like, you know, you have to believe all of these things, but she supported movement. Yeah.
I do want to play a clip from a speech that she gave. This was in a town hall in 1964, yeah. So about a year before her death. The speech is called The Black Revolution and the White Backlash. And she's talking about some of the tensions between white liberals and black activists. And she's also making a case for a more radical civil rights movement. Let's give it a listen and we'll talk.
My father died a disillusioned exile in another country. That is the reality that I am faced with when I get up and I read that some Negroes my own age and younger say that we must now lie down in the streets, tie up traffic, stop ambulances, do whatever we can, take to the hills if necessary with some guns, and fight back, you see. Can't you understand that this is the perspective from which we are now speaking? It isn't as if we got up today and said, you know, what can we do to irritate America? You know, it's because that since 1619, Negroes have tried every method of communication, of transformation of their situation, from petition to the vote, everything. We've tried it all. There isn't anything that hasn't been exhausted. Isn't it rather remarkable that we can talk about a people who were publishing newspapers while they were still in slavery in 1827, you see?
And she goes on from there. It's so moving. And I should say, I don't know if she had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer at the time, but clearly near her death.
Yes. One of the things that's interesting is that she was not told until the very end that she had cancer. And so she was very sick, but she didn't know. Very some she thought she had ulcers and, you know, and so it was sort of there's kind of this disorientation that you get a sense in her personal communications because she feels terrible. She knows how sick she is, but nobody tells her she's dying, but she is dying for several years.
Yeah. And she talks about her disillusioned father in exile.
Yes.
In another country.
Yeah. So her father, you know, so Lorraine's father was politically very different from a capitalist, right? Republican Party activist, like very kind of conventional believer in Americana. And fought the fight for civil rights in the completely respectable way that everybody told you to, and it ultimately was so frustrated that he said, I'm going to move my family to Mexico. And he goes to Mexico, and then he has a brain aneurysm while there. She's in high school, and so he dies, and they never move there, though she goes to Mexico later as a student. But that was such an important, you know, her father, this huge influence on her life, but also the sense that even with doing everything the right way, that he became embittered, you know, was influential for her.
Absolutely. She does die from pancreatic cancer, and you mm-hmm. describe her funeral, I think, something like 700 people came.
Yeah.
Malcolm X, who I guess had to be, in some degree of hiding?
He was absolutely in hiding at the point. He knew people were trying to kill him, but he had to make it to Lorraine's mm-hmm. funeral. And he was outside. I mean, it's sort of remarkable. And he's killed several weeks later. But it was an indication, because oftentimes she's not recognized for how central she was. And it's an indication, you know, the letters from King and Martin Luther King Jr. and Baldwin and all over the world and people who were there. I mean, it was a hugely it was devastating. It was a huge blow, her loss. Yeah.
You write at the end of the book that she should be remembered, or you want her to be remembered for the ways that she troubled the world.
Yes. Yeah, because, you know, she was really ahead of her time, right? So Hansberry was a feminist. She was trying to think through questions of how do one of the examples I give is when the Brown v. Board of Education opinion comes down, she's talking about Jomo Kenyatta in Kenya, right? That's her, she's thinking about sort of anti-colonialism almost a full decade before most Americans have gotten to the question, right? I mean, with feminism, before the feminist movement, she's trying to think about feminism. And she's thinking about the connection between feminism and her lesbianism, which doesn't really come into the feminist movement to even later, right? I mean, so she was constantly pushing forward, and also speaks to the issues we're talking about now.
Are you worried that somehow people are going to take the rough edges out of Lorraine Hansberry?
I think I'm not as worried, just because she was. I mean, you listen to some of her interviews, and you can't sanitize.
You can't,
sanitize Lorraine Hansberry.
Right.
And I actually think that one of the things that would be really exciting is if people are struggling with the ways in which they don't agree with her. Right. I mean, we need that, too, with these historic figures, not simply adulation, but actually dealing with the difficulty of the challenges they pose to us would be helpful. It would be helpful for us now with all kinds of political figures, actually.
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're going to end with Nina Simone, but I want you to talk about their relationship. And one of the things that she said about Lorraine Hansberry, we never talked about men or clothes or other inconsequential things. Marx, Lenin, and revolution. Real girl talk.
Yes.
I love
right.
that.
I mean, and Nina Simone really gave Lorraine credit for politicizing her. When she debuted at Carnegie Hall, she said Lorraine called her. And everybody else was calling to congratulate her. And Lorraine said, so what are you going to do for the movement? Right?
Oh, wow.
And that she brought her into organizing, which really changed the trajectory of Nina Simone's career. And really right after Lorraine Hansberry's death is the first time that Nina Simone had a severe psychiatric break. They were very close. Their homes were close by in upstate New York and, you know, in the Hudson Valley. And they turned to each other, you know, for Nina Simone was dealing with an abusive husband, a difficult relationship. Lorraine was sort of dealing with being closeted. They talked politics, they talked art, and they also provided emotional support. They were close, very close friends.
We're going to close with To Be Young, Gifted, and Black. What should people listen for?
So this was a song that Nina Simone wrote in response to a talk that was later published that Lorraine Hansberry delivered to young black writers about the gift of their identity, as opposed to seeing it as simply a source of difficulty or a burden to understand. It was a remarkable and beautiful thing.
Mm. Well, as always, Imani Perry, thank you for coming in and joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, Lorraine, Imani Perry's new book about Lorraine Hansberry is called Looking for Lorraine, The Radiant and Radical Life of Lorraine Hansberry. And our guest is a professor of African-American studies at Princeton University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out more about the program. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us.
are young, gifted and black. We must begin to tell how young there's a world waiting for you. Yours is the quest that's just begun. So when you're feeling real alone, there's a great truth that you should.